Thanks for giving me the chance to present this work, and also thank you for coming. So the talk will be about what we call deconfined mechanical quantum criticality. It will be based on this paper done with Debanjin. This is my outline. I will first introduce some background and tell you what kind of quantum free transitions I want to study. Then I will present some proposals and results. I'd like to start with this picture, which many of us have seen last Friday. I think, I'm not sure if Emily missed it, but you would like it if you had been here. I think this picture is supposed to tell people the features of our subject, condensed matter. I highlighted some of the features, the complex, amazing, exotic, unusual, a lot of potential, and one of the main features is we pack lots of stuff into teeny tiny spaces just to see what happens. Nowadays, we already kind of know what will happen. What will happen is many things can happen, and more is richer. And this is just very vividly reflected or predicted by this poem by William Blake, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." And the bottom line of this poem is really telling us the essence of condensed matter physics. That is, every quantum matter is an own universe. And as physicists who study quantum matters, we are really exploring different types of universes, and we would like to find exotic ones. This gives me a reason to review the landscape of quantum phases of matter that we know as of today. Another reason to review this is also because many of the phases will be encountered later in the talk. This is the landscape of the phases that we know as of today. It may be different tomorrow, but for today it's good. Quantum phases are roughly divided into two classes, gapped ones and gapless ones. And for the gapped ones, there are also two classes, short-range entangled ones and non-range entangled ones. And for the short-range entangled ones, there are also two classes, the so-called trivial-trivial states, which are simply product states, and they have no entanglement at all. And the more interesting types of states, symmetry-protected trivial states, also known as symmetry-protected topological states, SPT. These states are different from a product state, but if we allow ourselves to break some symmetry, they can be adiabatically connected to the trivial-trivial states. If we preserve the symmetries, they cannot. And some typical examples include the Haldane chain on the either time reversal symmetry or SO3 symmetry, and the bosonic integer quantum Hall state. This bosonic integer quantum Hall state, studied by many of us here, is a bosonic SPT state protected by U1 symmetry. It has a quantized electric Hall conductivity. And for the non-range entangled phases, we have the more familiar topological orders, like our favorite Z2 topological order. Another example we will encounter later is a chiral spin liquid. This is a 2+1D topological order that has a single non-trivial anionic excitation, which is a semion. It's called chiral spin liquid because it has one chiral edge mode. And more recently, people are studying fractal-like phases. These are gapped phases, but much less is known about gapless phases. So here, let me just classify them by the mechanisms that protect the gaplessness of the system. In the first class, the gaplessness is protected by the Goldstone theorem. Namely, in the system, there's some continuous symmetry that is spontaneously broken. Then due to the Goldstone theorem, there will be some gapless mode. For example, in the crystal, due to the spontaneous breaking of continuous translation symmetry, we have gapless phonon. The other type of gapless phases is protected by the symmetries that are not broken but preserved. One example is a Fermi liquid state. So for these phases, if we have the symmetries, they are perturbably stable. But if we break the symmetry, either explicitly or spontaneously, the system can be gapped. For example, in the context of a Fermi liquid, if we have a translation symmetry and a U1 charge conservation symmetry, then it's perturbably stable. But if we are willing to break either spontaneously or explicitly the U1 symmetry, then it can be gapped. And the last type, of gapless phrases are the phrases where the gaplessness is not protected by any symmetry. Namely, if you add any symmetry breaking local perturbations, it's still stable. I call it gapless phrases protected by the entanglement pattern. One typical example is a three-dimensional U1 quantum spin liquid where all the electric charge and the magnetic monopoles are gapped. Okay.
What do you mean by protected by entanglement pattern?
Meaning it's not protected by symmetry. The protection mechanism is not related to symmetry.
Then it doesn't need anything to protect it. Why do you say it's protected by entanglement?
Because it's a feature of the phase. If you go to another phase, it will not have this feature. So here we see we have many different quantum phases, and some of them maybe you will consider exotic. Then we also want to consider the phase transitions between different quantum phases. And maybe you will wonder, now that we already have so many different interesting quantum phases, why do we still want to consider their quantum phase transitions? After all, on the phase diagram, most of the regions will be occupied by the phases, and the phase transition will only occupy some measure zero phase boundary. So why should we care about them? And there are a couple of reasons that I think we should care about them. The first one is if the phase transition is continuous, then it may be described by some interesting universality class, which is interesting on its own. On the other hand, in order to understand the phase transition between two phases, we have to understand the intricate interplay among all the relevant degrees of freedom in the entire system. So the understanding of phase transition enables us to have a unified understanding not only of the phase transition itself, but also of the nearby phases and even including the crossover of physics. So this is my manifesto for why quantum phase transitions are interesting and important to study. Let me also give some examples. Here I will just give some examples instead of being systematic, because it's really hard to be very systematic here. So the most classic type of quantum phase transitions we know are the spontaneous symmetry breaking transitions in insulators. We at least nowadays, we often think there are roughly two classes. One is the so-called Landau-Ginzburg paradigm, where one phase preserves all symmetry and the other phase breaks some symmetry spontaneously. So the symmetry groups, the symmetry group in one phase is a subgroup of the other. And in more modern perspectives, we also know there can be the so-called deconfined quantum criticality. Here, the two phases also break some symmetries, but the symmetry groups of the two phases are not, the symmetry group of one phase is not the subgroup of the other. And later you will see the spirit of this deconfined criticality will be reflected in the phase transition I want to discuss. Another classic type of quantum phase transitions happens in metal. So these transitions happen in insulator. These happen in metal. Quantum phase transitions in metal are harder to study because of the abundant gapless degrees of freedom around the Fermi surface. For metallic quantum phase transitions, one typical example is the metal insulator transition. Here I will focus on the case where we have translation symmetry, so we can talk about the Fermi surface. In general, you can also talk about cases where translation symmetries are strongly broken, so you can drive a metal insulator transition by localization. I will not consider that case here. So for such types of metal insulator transition, the simplest mechanism is the so-called Lifshitz transition, where we start from the metal and shrink the size of the Fermi surface, and then shrink it to zero and turn the metal into an insulator. This is a much better understood Lifshitz transition. Then more recently, there's another type of metal insulator transition. I would like to call it the center transition. It turns an electronic Fermi surface in the metal into something else in the insulator. That something else is still a Fermi surface, but not a Fermi surface of the electrons. Instead, it's a Fermi surface of some emergent neutral excitations. Because the spirit of this transition will also be reflected later, so I'd like to review it in more details. This transition, you can find more details in this paper. This transition is between a Fermi liquid metal and an insulator. This solid circle represents the Fermi surface of the metal. And this dashed circle represents the Fermi surface of the emergent neutral excitation. To study such a transition, we can do such a pattern construction where so this C is the annihilation operator of the electrons with spin up and spin down. We write it as a product of a bosonic operator B and a fermionic operator F. B is often called a chargeon because we let it carry the charge, and F is often called a spinon because we often let it carry the spin. You can see from this pattern construction, there's a U1 gauge redundancy. Namely, if we multiply B and F by such U1 phase factors, this expression is invariant. And this actually implies at low energy, the system will be described by some emergent U1 gauge field. Now, let's see how such a formulation or pattern construction can describe this phase transition. To do it, we need to consider how we can use this pattern construction to describe the Fermi nuclear phase and the insulating phase. And to describe a phase here, what we have to do is to consider what kind of state we put F into and what kind of state we put B into. For F, I will just give it a generic Fermi surface. By generic, I mean a Fermi surface with generic features and that has no special properties like nesting and others. And for the boson, I will tune the microscopic Hamiltonian of my system to choose it to be either condensed or gapped. If it's condensed, then due to the Higgs effect, the U1 gauge field will be unimportant at low energies. And then from this expression, you see C and F, they just differ by a number. The Fermi surface of F will become a Fermi surface of C. So this state is simply a Fermi liquid. On the other hand, if I let B have a gap, then this will imply a charge gap of the electron. So we have an insulator. Now the question is, what kind of insulator we have here? What's its nature? To answer this question, we need to look at the low energy dynamics of the system. Now the bosons are gapped, and the low energy dynamics is determined by the gapless fermions near the Fermi surface and the U1 gauge field. So this problem of a Fermi surface coupled to a U1 gauge field has been studied by many people before, and it's been believed to be a stable phase, although there's some recent debate whether in some models it can emerge. As a phase, we can still speak of it. And the Fermi surface coupled to a U1 gauge field is stable, and this is an insulator with a Fermi surface of the neutral emergent neutral excitation F. Sometimes people also call this neutral Fermi surface a ghost Fermi surface. Then from this description, you can see to describe this quantum phase transition, what we have to do is to consider the condensation transition of B. So far, this sounds very simple, but actually, the really difficult part is to understand the low energy dynamics of this coupled system, where at the critical point, B, F, and A, they are all gapless. So it's a strongly coupled system. It's very hard to study, which was studied here. Okay, so this is a more modern type of metal insulator transition, and I think you will, at least I think this is more interesting than a simple Lipschitz transition. So now let me tell you what I want to discuss here. I want to discuss some more exotic phase transitions that happen in metals. And there are two main types that I want to discuss. One is what we call the deconfined MOS transition. This is a transition in this panel A. It's between a Fermi liquid metal and an insulator that has no emergent neutral Fermi surface. So to compare this one with Centaur's metal insulator transition, the insulating side of Centaur has a neutral Fermi surface. Here, I don't want the Fermi surface. So I want to get rid of the Fermi surface of the metal by one shot. Relatedly, I want to discuss this so-called Fermi transition, which we also call a deconfined metal-metal transition. It's between two metals that both have Fermi surfaces, but with different sizes. So the size of the Fermi surface jumps immediately at the transition. Maybe you can already see these two types of transitions can be related. For example, here, suppose I have two orbitals of electrons. I call one of the orbitals the cold electron, the other orbital the hot electron. I will let cold electron and hot electrons both have Fermi surfaces. Say the hot electrons have a Fermi surface represented by this small circle, and the cold electron has a Fermi surface represented by the big circle. Then suppose I can drive a deconfined Mott transition for the hot electrons and ask the cold electrons to just remain as spectators of the phase transition. Then from the perspective of the entire system, this is a Fermi transition, because across the transition, the size of the Fermi surface changes by the amount of the Fermi surface size of the hot electrons. And there's a related Fermi, such a relation can also be generalized here. You can have hot and cold electrons in a system and let hot electron undergo a Santos transition. Then you also have two different metals with different sizes of electronic Fermi surfaces. And this is studied in this paper.
Is it necessary that two orbitals have different sizes of Fermi surfaces?
No. Generically, they will have different size. You need some careful tuning to make them have the same size.
Okay.
Okay, so these are the types of phase transitions I want
so
to do.
In the Lipschitz transition, does the Fermi surface continuously shrink down to zero?
Yeah.
And here there's a jump from the big one to the small one.
Yeah, so immediately, sorry, maybe I should clarify this more clearly. Immediately across the transition, the size of the Fermi surface is already finite. This is different from a Lipschitz transition, where immediately across the transition, the size of the Fermi surface is infinitesimal. So these are the phase transitions I want to discuss. So in more fancy words, these are the universes we want to explore. But we're actually more practical than just that. We actually have some experimental motivation to study them, not just to explore the infinitely many universes. So this is a picture of the data of this heavy fermion compound. And this is a phase diagram of a couplet from these two papers, respectively. So let me not explain what that really means. But basically, this represents the size of the Fermi surface. And when you tune the pressure here, you see the size of the Fermi surface jumps immediately. Here, too, there's nowadays evidence that when you tune the doping, you go from the pseudo gap region to the overdoped region, the size of the Fermi surface seems to jump immediately. I have to mention there's always some debate in analyzing and interpreting the data for such kind of geometrically related systems. But the existence of such phenomena also gives us the experimental motivations to study the phase transitions we just discussed.
So experimentally, how can they tell there's no mutual Fermi surface?
Usually it's hard.
And in these experiments, is it clear that it goes to an insulating state, or it's probably a mutual Fermi surface state?
My understanding is the generic belief is there's no mutual Fermi surface, but I cannot be as responsible as what I will say for myself to that statement. Okay, so with all these motivations, we would like to have some critical theories for the deconfined Mott transition and the Fermi transition. Okay, now I will tell you how we would like to approach it. We will first propose and use this U2 gauge theory. So let me describe this U2 gauge theory. You will see it's very similar to Santos U1 gauge theory. Here, C1 and C2 again are the electronic annihilation operators with spin up and spin down. This time we write it as B times F again, but B this time is a matrix instead of a number. And you can see there's a U2 gauge redundancy in this construction. Namely, if we transform B and F by such a U2 transformation, the construction is invariant. This tells us the system is actually described by B and F interacting with an emergent U2 gauge field at no energies. In our paper, you can find more details of this U2 gauge construction, including the gauge constraints and how to build up the physical Hilbert space and so on. Here, let me just mention the symmetry assignment I want to use for this talk. Again, the symmetry assignment is not unique. There are many projective symmetry groups. Here, I will just use a very simple one. So basically, I will assign all the quantum numbers on the global symmetries to B, and let F only carry the fermionic statistics of the electron. So for example, the U1 charge conservation symmetry is assigned to B, SU2 spin rotation is assigned to B, and time reversal, and only on the lattice symmetries, both B and F will change to the corresponding positions. R prime is the transformed position of R. Okay. Now, let's see how we can use this U2 gauge theory to describe different phases. Let's start from this metallic phase. Again, to describe the phases, what we need to do is to specify what B and F are put into, what states they are put into. So for F, let me give it a generic Fermi surface. And B, again, I let it condense. Then due to, similar to the U1 case, here, due to the Higgs effect, condensing B in a generic channel will Higgs the U2 completely, and we will get a Fermi liquid of the electrons. For example, if we choose to condense B in such a channel, you can check all the symmetries described in the last, in the previous page are preserved, and we obtain a symmetric Fermi liquid. And if we let B condense in such a channel, we break some of the symmetry, and this is in fact a ferromagnetic Fermi liquid. And you can also have anti-ferromagnetic Fermi liquid and so on, and even orthogonal metals. Okay, metallic phases. Now let's see how we understand insulating phases from this picture. So this time, I will let F pair up. I will develop some paired state of F for this purpose. And in particular, I want the pair, the Cooper pair, to be in the SU2 singlet channel. In fact, to simplify the problem, I want it to be the SU2 singlet and S-loop channel. And this can be achieved by tuning some macroscopic parameters in my system. And this will Higgs the U2 gauge structure to SU2. For B, I will give it a gap. And then again, this implies a charge gap of the electron, and we have an insulator. Now the question is, what kind of insulator we are having here? What's its nature? So at this point, you can see all the matter sectors, F and B, are all gapped. So the nature of the resulting insulator is determined by the dynamics of the remaining SU2 gauge field. It turns out there are different gapped states of B that I can put into, and that was part of the reason why I wanted to introduce the gapped phases at the very beginning. And depending on the nature of this gapped state of B, I will have different natures for the insulator of electron. For example, if I let B be in a trivial state, this is what I call a type 1 state of B, then at no energies, there's the matter sector really doesn't do anything. There's only the SU2 gauge field. The SU2 gauge field will confine. This is a generic belief. And it turns out the resulting state is just a conventional insulator, a short-range entangled insulator. I can also have a type 2 state, which is a SPT of B. It's an here by SPT, I mean an SPT under the U2 gauge symmetry. Then below the gap of B, there will be a transaminous action for the SU2 gauge field generically, and the generically the resulting state is a topological order. I can also choose B to be a non-range entangled state. I can let B have a topological order by itself. This time, the SU2 gauge field will still confine, but interestingly, after a little thought, you will see this topological order will not confine. And eventually, you still get some kind of topological order. Type 4 is we combine 2 and 3. We put some topological order on top of the SPT. Below the gap of B, we both have the topological order and the transaminous for SU2. So we will have some more generic, maybe more complicated topological order. There are examples for all the 4 types in the paper, you can find more details. Let me mention one example, that is, suppose I put B into a bosonic integer quantum Hall state in type 2. So a bosonic integer quantum Hall state, previously I mentioned, is a U1 SPT. Actually, it's compatible with the U2 symmetry. We had some discovery on the way to the Niagara 4 about this relation. If we put B into a bosonic integer quantum Hall state, you have to do some kind of relatively hard work, and you will eventually see the resulting state is a chiral spin liquid. Okay, so much for insulating phases. In fact, this theory can also describe a fractionalized Fermi liquid or FL star. So what is FL star? FL star is just a Fermi liquid on top of a quantum spin liquid or topological order that are essentially decoupled from each other in the renormalization group sense. And to describe it here, what we need to do is to introduce another type of electrons denoted by D. Say this can be our code electrons. Then the theory for the combined system can be described by action of this form, the action of the hot electrons C, the cold electrons, which are giving a generic Fermi surface and their coupling. So you see this coupling here is just the usual hybridization between the two types of electrons. If we let B condense, then as we discussed before, we will have a Fermi liquid of C. Now, due to the hybridization of them, the resulting system is just a Fermi liquid of the of both the C and the D electrons. If we let B have a gap, as we discussed in the previous page, we will have a topological order of C, and then the hybridization between them will be irrelevant, and we will have a FL star. By changing what kind of gap the state B is in, I can change the topological order here and change the FL star here. So the bottom line here is this U2 gauge theory is very powerful in describing many different phases. Okay? Now, I would like to use this U2 gauge theory to propose possible mechanisms for the interesting phase transitions I want to study, deconfined mode transitions and the Fermi transitions. Here I will limit myself to just presenting some possible mechanisms, and I will just give very general remarks. More justification of the mechanisms will be next. Okay, so let's start from the deconfined mode transition. Let's recall we want to describe a phase transition between a Fermi liquid metal with a Fermi surface and an insulator without any Fermi surface, not even any neutral Fermi surface. And as we said before, the Fermi liquid can be viewed as a phase where B is condensed and F has a Fermi surface. And the insulator is a phase where B is gapped, where F is paired up. Then from this description, we can see the deconfined mode transition can be described from Fermi liquid to the insulator. It can be described by gapping out B and pairing up F. But we want to have a continuous phase transition without fine tuning. Then the question is, can we do these two things together at one time? Can we kill the two birds by one stone? It turns out to be possible, and the insight comes from the so-called color superconductivity, and there are some standard reviews of this subject. Here, let me just provide some intuitive simplified pictures for why color superconductivity will happen. So this is a Feynman diagram that tells us the interaction mediated by an SU2 gauge field among the fermions. By integrating out the SU2 gauge field in the middle, you can look at the interaction among the fermions. It turns out the result is in the singular channel of the SU2, the interaction is attractive. Simplified, you can either calculate this Feynman diagram or there's a simplified picture to understand it. That is, so for this SU2 gauge field, we can always expand it in terms of the generators of SU2. Say the generators are T1, T2, and T3. We expand it in terms of A1 to A3. Now instead of looking at the entire SU2, let me just focus on one of the three generators, A3, T3. T3 is just this poly matrix divided by 2. And you can see F1 is acted by this element. F2 is acted by this element. You will see F1 and F2 carry positive and negative charges on the A3, respectively. So they carry opposite charges, and there will be attraction between them mediated by A3. And when you generalize it to the entire SU2, you will actually see the singular channel of SU2 is actually attractive. And this tells us if we have a Fermi surface, if we have fermions with a Fermi surface that are coupled to a SU2 gauge field, it will actually automatically pair up.
So is this attraction enhanced once you promote it to SU2 or is it suppressed a little bit?
Compared to what?
Compared to in one case, the T3 you consider here.
It's enhanced.
Okay.
you also need to change the unit. I mean, after changing the unit, I mean, it's not that well defined. You will change the unit. If you use the same unit, it's enhanced.
Okay.
Okay. But I'm not considering SU2. I'm considering U2. U2 differs by SU2 by U1 component. So previously we said SU2 will promote pairing of the Fermi surface. But now we have also a U2 gauge field. What will happen in this case? It turns out the other U1 will suppress pairing. And the intuitive physical picture is this. From here, you will also see, actually, in the last page, I led a little bit to you, the picture was overly simplified. Here, you can kind of see why. This is a Fermi surface. And we know pairing happens most favorably in the two antipodal patches of the Fermi surface. And look at these two patches. You will see they have opposite Fermi velocities, right? So they have opposite currents. From high school, we have learned if we have electric currents of the same direction, there will be attractive Ampere interaction. If they are in opposite directions, there will be a repulsive Ampere interaction. Here we see they are in opposite directions. So this U1 gauge field will mediate repulsive appearing interaction among the fermions. That's why the U1 gauge field will actually suppress pairing. And the SU2 will enhance pairing. So eventually, whether the Fermi surface will pair up, whether it's stable against the pairing, will be determined by the competition between U1 and SU2. Let me explain why I want this U1 gauge field in the next page. But here, let me just comment the possible scenarios here. So let me draw a possible schematic phase diagram in the parameter space spanned by M squared and V. Here, M squared tells us the gap of the boson. In the right side, the boson has a gap, it's not condensed. In the left side, it is condensed for each of the figure. And V is the short-range fermion-fermion interaction of the F. And if B is condensed, the short-range interaction becomes the short-range interaction of the electrons. So in the left side, where B is condensed, if we have some repulsive short-range interaction of among the fermions, and here I'm assuming the fermions have a Fermi surface, then we will just have a Fermi stable Fermi liquid. If we have attractive interactions among the fermions, then due to Cooper instability, we will have a superconductor. If B is gapped, here we said, depending on the result of this competition, the Fermi surface may or may not be stable. If it's possible that in the entire parameter regime, it's just unstable, so we will have an insulator that has no neutral Fermi surface. It's also possible in part of the parameter space, the Fermi surfaces are unstable, and in the other part is stable. So in this part, we will have an insulator with no emergent neutral Fermi surfaces, but on the other part, we do have it. And we can also have this scenario where the phase boundaries are a little bit different. So only in case A and B, we can possibly have a deconfined mode transition without fine tuning between a Fermi liquid and an insulator. Otherwise, like in this case, we may just go into a superconductor. So later we want to examine which case will happen. But here, let me just assume SU2 can win over the competition and the Fermi surfaces will be unstable. I will justify it later. By justify it, I really mean I will just provide some evidence of that. Let me here just provide a possible critical theory for this deconfined mode transition. This theory written here is assuming the insulator of B is of type 1, but you can also easily generalize it to other types. The theory looks like this. It has a couple of terms. The first one describes the dynamics of B that is coupled to the U2 gauge field. A is the U2 gauge field. And this is the coupling between F and the U2 gauge field. A finite mu F tells us there's a Fermi surface. And there's also the coupling between B and F. Importantly here, because of the gauge invariance, B cannot be directly coupled to fermion bilinears. Only bilinears of B can be coupled to bilinears of fermions. And finally, we have the usual Maxwell-Young-Mills Lagrangian for the U2 gauge field. So here E and G they are the U1 and the SU2 gauge couplings. They are genetically independent. So previously we said if we tune the mass of B and let it condense, we can have a Fermi liquid. If we have assumed if we tune the mass to be positive and gap out B, we assumed the Fermi surface will be immediately unstable and we obtain an insulator without neutral Fermi surface. That's still assumed here. Now at the critical point, in order to have a generic continuous transition without any fine tuning, I want there to be only one relevant perturbation that's controlled by this M squared. In particular, pairing needs to be irrelevant at the critical point, even if pairing is relevant in the insulating side. So the key for this transition to happen is really that pairing of fermions is dangerously relevant at this critical point. You may wonder whether it's possible because as I assumed, when the boson is gapped, pairing is immediately relevant. Why is it possible to have pairing to be irrelevant at the critical point? It turns out to be possible, although I cannot really prove it at the moment. It's possible because at the critical point, the B is gapless. And from the previous study, people know this gapless B will have very strong impact in the dynamics of the fermion sector and the gauge field sector. It will, in particular, it will change the property of the pairing stability a lot. So it's possible that in the insulating side where B is gapped, SU2 wins over the competition, but at the critical point, U1 wins. And this is really the reason why I want to consider U2 gauge theory instead of SU2 gauge theory. I need this U2 gauge field to suppress pairing at the critical point. Otherwise, if I only have an SU2 gauge field, then at the critical point, pairing will still be relevant. And I will have two relevant perturbations. The transition can't be continuous without fine tuning.
By dangerously irrelevant, do you mean marginally irrelevant? What do you mean by dangerous?
By dangerously relevant, I mean it's irrelevant at the critical point, but it's relevant once I go to your phase.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with whether it's marginal or not. Okay, related to this mechanism of deconfined mode transition, we can also propose a possible related mechanism for Fermi transition. So again, this is our hot electron and a cold electron. I just let the hot electron undergo the deconfined mode transition. And if the cold electrons will remain as spectators, then the entire system will be a Fermi transition. The entire system will have a Fermi transition. So the key for this Fermi transition to work is the coupling between the hot and the cold electrons are dangerously irrelevant at the critical point. Any questions?
So the cold electrons are not coupled to gauge field.
Yeah. Okay. As many of you can see, these are just words. We need some justification. Next, I will provide some justification. But at this stage, I would like to admit the justification is not complete yet. We have done some RG analysis to the leading non-trivial order, but we also know higher order corrections will be important. I will not be able to say much about what's the nature of the higher order corrections. I will just comment on the possible scenarios at the end. Okay, so let's start with the justification of the deconfined mode transition. As we just discussed, I think the first question we need to ask is if B is gapped, whether it's really true that the Fermi surface will be immediately unstable to pairing. So let's ask this question. Are Fermi surfaces coupled to a U2 gauge field stable against the pairing? This is a kind of a hard problem. It's a nonlinear gauge field, and we are always scared of nonlinear gauge fields. Let's start with a simplified version. Instead of considering a U2 gauge theory, let's consider a simplified U1 cross U1 gauge theory. So here, let's consider two Fermi surfaces, Fermi surface 1 and Fermi surface 2. Fermi surface 1 is coupled to a U1 gauge field A1, and 2 is coupled to a U1 gauge field A2. A1 and A2 can also couple. Let me also assume exchange symmetry between the 1s and 2s. Then we can do a change of variables to AC and AS and look at the Fermi surfaces. So let's zoom into the Fermi surfaces. Now, the Fermi surface 1 is coupled to AC plus AS. Fermi surface 2 is coupled to AC minus AS. You see, AC is uniformly coupled to every Fermi surface. So this is just the usual U1 gauge field coupled to Fermi surface story, and it will generate repulsive Ampere interaction and surprise pairing. Let's look at the AS. Let's focus on this patch and this patch. In momentum space, they're really on top of each other. I'm just displacing them to show for clarity. So patch 1 and patch 2, they can have pairing. And the Fermi velocity of patch 1 and patch 4, they're opposite. But they also carry opposite charges on the AS. So on the AS, patch 1 and patch 4 actually have currents in the same direction. Then that's telling us AS will mediate some attractive interaction, attractive Ampere interaction between them. The same is true for patch 2 and patch 3. So this is telling us AS will actually promote pairing. And again, you see whether the Fermi surface is stable depends on the competition between AS and AC. This is very similar to the U2 story, where the U1 gauge field suppresses pairing and the SU2 gauge field promotes pairing. And in fact, here, this AS is what I called A3 before. Okay. This is just a physical picture, but to have a more quantitative understanding, we will turn to this RG analysis based on this patch formulation. The patch formulation is a has been developed by a known line of previous studies. And the essence of the patch formulation is for such a problem, we can first focus on the coupling between the antipodal patches of the Fermi surface and the gauge field whose momentum is tangential to these two patches. We first focus on the coupling between them, and then we will glue the patches together to get a theory of the entire Fermi surface. The no energy effect theory in this two patch theory reason this way. So psi alpha p has a color index alpha and a patch index positive or negative, patch positive plus patch minus patch. And this is the kinetic term of the fermion near the Fermi surface. And this is the usual Kf times the momentum term of the energy. And Kf is set to 1 here. And this term is due to the curvature of the Fermi surface. And this is the time derivative term. And here is the coupling between the fermion and the gauge field. And we also have the Maxwell action for the gauge fields. Here you notice I introduced some other parameters, n and epsilon. N is the number of flavors of the fermions. It will be used for controlled calculation. Epsilon, this is the definition of epsilon. And for our physical case, epsilon is equal to 1. It's also introduced to control the calculation. In this theory, we will focus on the dimensionless gauge couplings, alpha c and alpha s defined here, where lambda is a UV cutoff. Then we can do the RG calculation and obtain the beta functions of alpha c and alpha s at the leading non-trivial order. The beta functions look like this. I don't want to read it, you can see it. From these two beta functions, you can also deduce that the beta function of the ratio of alpha c and alpha s is actually RG invariant. So this ratio is RG invariant. Then we can see the fixed point value of alpha c and alpha s will be given by these expressions, where R is the ratio of alpha c and alpha s in the UV. This is an RG invariant quantity at this order, so R is just a constant under RG, and it's determined by some microscopic details, which is non-universal. And you can see by tuning R, I actually have a non-trivial fixed line. Okay, this is for the two-patch theory. Now, I need to study pairing instability. I need to glue different patches together and do the RG. And the method was developed in this paper. We can generalize it here. So the idea is we glue the patches together, and when we do RG, we need to integrate out some high energy modes. When doing that, the patches will also be shrunk to smaller ones. And there are two contributions to the RG flow of the fermion interactions. Let me denote the fermion interaction strength by V. The first contribution is this minus V squared. This is the usual Fermi liquid contribution. Even if there's no gauge field, just for the ordinary Fermi liquid, we have this contribution. And the other two terms comes from the effect of gauge field. So it's represented by these Feynman diagrams. The solid lines represent the fermions, and the dashed line represents the gauge field. When we integrate out the some high energy gauge modes, we will effectively generate the interactions among the fermions. That's reflected in this beta function. Here, the first term, alpha c, comes from the effect for AC. As you can see, it's positive, so it suppresses pairing as we expected. And the second term comes from AS, it enhances pairing because it has a negative sign. So the bottom line here is really what the pairing instability depends on some non-universal details of the system. In particular, is parameterized by this ratio R. If R is smaller than zero, if R is smaller than one, then we are in, this is the fixed line of the two patch theory. Then we are, if R is smaller than one, we are in the dashed region. V will flow to negative infinity because the first term is already negative, the second term is negative. It just keeps flowing to negative infinity. And the pairing instability will occur. If R is larger than one or equal to one, then we are in the solid region where you can show actually there's a regime where V will not flow to negative infinity, but to some non-negative values. So this is the regime where the Fermi surfaces are perturbatively stable. So the result at this leading non-trivial order is telling us it is possible that Fermi surfaces will be immediately unstable once the bosons are gapped. At this point, let's look at the U2, the full U2 case. As we mentioned, due to the non-abelian nature, this U2 gauge theory may be more complicated. And some of the complications come from the self-interaction among the gluons, because it's a non-abelian gauge field, and also the coupling to the Fede Popov ghost. But it turns out, fortunately, there's a big simplification in the patch formulation. Once you go to the patch formulation and do the two-level scaling, you will see these two are immediately irrelevant. So the U2 gauge field becomes effectively quasi-abelianized. They look like some abelian gauge fields. And eventually, the results will be very similar to the U1 cross U1 problem, almost identical. So in the two patch theory, there's still a non-trivial fixed line, and the pairing instability depends on some microscopic details. Here again, it's parameterized by the ratio between the U1 gauge coupling and the SU2 gauge coupling. And this ratio again is RG invariant to the leading order. So the lesson here is for the full U2 problem, once the bosons are gapped, it's still possible that the Fermi surface will be immediately unstable. But this non-trivial fixed line is kind of worrisome to me, because after taking into account higher order contributions, the case can be very different. Due to the technical challenges, I will not be able to really say anything about the nature of the higher order corrections. Let me just say some scenarios. So in the first scenario, maybe the fixed line for some reason is just stable. Then we still, in part of the fixed line, we have a stable Fermi surface. This is by itself very interesting because it's a 2+1D system with translation symmetry that is described by a fixed line. I think there's no other example that has this feature, a 2+1D system with translation symmetry described by a fixed line, and this is the critical system, and the critical exponents can be tuned continuously along the fixed line. Fermi liquid is an example which is described by a fixed hypersurface, but the exponents cannot be tuned. And the other part is unstable, and this part may be more relevant to the study, the transitions we want to study. The second scenario is after high order corrections are taken into account, maybe the fixed line will collapse into a couple of fixed points. I just drew some fixed points by hand. And then we need to ask whether these fixed points correspond to cases where pair instability will occur or not. And the third scenario is maybe after taking into account the high order corrections, the fixed line will just disappear altogether, even in the two patch theory. That's telling us the patch theory is not capturing the full physics, and some detail, some microscopic details beyond the patch formulation will enter to determine the physics. We don't know the answer yet. And let me also remark, so far this is only for the case where B is gapped. We are just studying whether we can really get the phase by one step. We haven't gone to the critical point. After pinning down which scenario will happen, we still need to go to the critical point and examine the dynamics there to see whether the transition is really continuous. So there's still a lot to do. Okay, let me summarize. So I presented the two metallic quantum phase transitions that we want to study, and we propose a powerful U2 gauge theory to describe different quantum phases and phase transitions, and we propose mechanisms for these two transitions. The mechanisms may be possible, but when we use an RG to justify them, at the moment we just have some evidence that it may work, but we do not really know, and there's more work to be done. Thanks.
Do you have some guess about what kind of microscopic model will realize this kind of part-on description?
No.
Yeah.
Huh? The same?
So I claim that's it. My probably Aramex recognize it, maybe, I don't know.
So in Aram's paper, he discovered this chiral spin equivalent triangular Hopper model. And if there's a direct transition from a liquid to this kind of similar liquid, then falls in Liu-Jin's description that could be into this UISPT. Also, actually, as a general question, like whenever you have a part-ton construction, is there any kind of guide about what possible would be, like what kind of microscopic model can possibly realize those things?
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe you know?
Oh,
by the way, Aaron's model is just a simple Hopper model on triangular lattice.
But there is also like a lot of different part-on description for
that. And many other models. You know, at the end, I want to mention this, which what I call the challenge of, or the dream of ultimate understanding. By that I mean, I want to have an intrinsic understanding of the universal physics of some many body system without referring to any Hamiltonian or Lagrangian or wave function. This is possible, for example, for 1+1 DCFT, you don't need to know the Hamiltonian and so on. For topological order, you don't need to know the Hamiltonian and so on. You can already understand the universal physics. If this can also be done here, it would be great. Having the Hamiltonian is very useful, but eventually, maybe after 5 years or 5,000 years, we may have this ultimate understanding.
Did you analyze the critical point, the dynamics of the critical point?
Not really. I looked at the boson sector. It's kind of complicated.
Okay. Is there any like intuition to understand why the gap-based boson can help you to suppress the?
Oh, there is. That's a good question, because I didn't have time, so I didn't mention it. This was first, I think it was first discussed by Senthil in his paper, and that was actually the key why he can have his transition. The point is, this boson undergoes a transition that can be described by a CFT. And due to you know, for CFT, there's no anomalous dimension for current, for U1 current. So when this boson is coupled to the gauge field, it will contribute a universal part to the gauge field effective action, determined by the universal conductivity. That's precisely the universal conductivity. And then this will change the dynamical exponent of the gauge field. Namely, it will change the epsilon. Recall that epsilon was very important eventually to determine the pairing stability. If it will change epsilon from 1 to 0. So it changes the story a lot.
Could you comment more on this? Were they RG plots on the previous page where you had this line? You're saying they were tunable critical exponents?
Oh.
Right, so I guess it was figure A.
Yeah.
So you're saying basically there's like, is this like an infinite number of fixed points here? Okay.
Yeah, and if I just use the leading order results,
mm-hmm.
I can calculate the 2KF for singularity. The critical exponents for the 2KF varies continuously along the line for the U2 gauge theory. You may also say Fermi liquid is also an example which is described by not only a fixed line but a fixed hypersurface because we can tune the Fermi parameters. But when you tune the Fermi parameters, the critical exponents do not change.
I see. But they do here.
They do here.
Yes.
If that's true, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a 1 plus 1D example, but it's not usually a 1D example.
And it also is, but it's in 1 plus 1D. I was mentioning in high dimensions.
In high dimension, you also get this link cost to 4 super young meals.
Okay.
Yeah, it's also another example.
So if you want translation symmetry, but not, I think there are also examples with disorder. So if you want translation symmetry and don't want super symmetry, then I don't know any other example. Yeah.
Is there any physical signature of this paired F fermions?
What do you mean?
Like, is there some like observable that tells you that the F fermions have been paired in this description of the insulator?
Instead of having a Fermi surface?
I don't know. I mean, if it's an insulator, there are many roots to get an insulator, but here you have a description which, you know, the spin-ons on one side are paired together. Is there some physical manifestation of this pairing?
Compared to the case where there's a neutral Fermi surface, this one's gapped.
Yeah, but I think pairing is a more it's a specific mechanism, right?
I guess you're asking.
It's some equivalent of like a Meissner effect for your partons, right? Like some.
I guess, can I phrase it in this way? You're asking, so here I'm letting the Fs pair up.
Yeah.
Suppose I just give it a band gap without making them pairing up.
Sure.
Can I obtain an insulator? Can I phrase it in this way?
Yeah, I guess, is there a way to like distinguish the mechanism you propose from, I don't know, some hypothetical other mechanism? Like maybe there's another way to describe such a transition.
I think it would not be easy to distinguish such mechanisms. That's also part of the reason I think the ultimate understanding is really more intrinsic. This mechanism is just a picture. Eventually we may get the understanding. But to distinguish different mechanisms is usually hard. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If, for example, in some this kind of materials, we still don't know whether the superconductivity is due to boron or some other collective modes.
Yeah.
But maybe I guess you may also be asking. Now the picture I'm providing is to pair up the fermions. Whether it's equivalent to some other picture, I don't really know. Maybe it is. But let me mention one, weld thought. So this transition is now formulated in terms of a gauge data design. I kind of have a belief or a tendency of thought to think that critical gauge theories without any quasi-particles are all just illusions. Eventually, these theories can all be formulated in terms of Nando-Ginzburg coupled to a Fermi surface. I just don't know how to do it. For example, the DQCP, the standard DQCP, originally it was described by gauge theory. Later, people realized it could also be realized as a nonlinear signal model.
But it's not Nando-Ginzburg.
Why not? It's, by Nando-Ginzburg, I just mean it's formulated by the local order plan.
Yeah, but that's not Nando-Ginzburg, right? Nando-Ginzburg also contains like,
things
like
5-4
theory.
I also call the SO5 nonlinear signal model Nando-Ginzburg. As long as it's formulated by local order parameter, I call it Nando-Ginzburg.
Thank you.
Thanks.